Choose your next words carefully, Leonidas. They may be your last.
Madman. You're a madman. Blasphemy. This is madness.
This is Sparta!
Who do we have left? Britney Spears. Cam Kardashian. Paris Hilton. And that's what we have to look forward to, Kanye West. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Good afternoon. Good evening. We're global.
I mean, the lines are blowing up.
And our shop, which is actorsbreakdown.com/shop, S-H-O-P-P-E. Oh, look at you. All right, everybody. I'll be right with you. I'm a good guy. If you attack us, I attack you. Here he is, Brian. Hello, my name is Brian Hammer Jackson, and you're with the Brian Hammer Jackson Show. Boy, he was powerful. This is a no-win situation.
Good morning, everybody. I hope I'm broadcasting. I am Brian Hammer Jackson, and I'm talking to you on the radio. Normally, we have a radio show with guest interviews, and I always wanted to do something. Always wanted to do something that is special. I never tried it before, almost like a podcast kind of thing. Tonight or today, we talk about murder. But before we do that, I want to play, or I want to say something. We lost a dear friend a year ago, and she was also a buff, a movie buff, and she loved these stories too. So, Diane, rest in peace. This story is for you. All right, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I am Brian Hammer Jackson. We're broadcasting worldwide. If you'd like to come into the studio, today is a very special broadcast that close to my heart that I want to talk about. I had experience in Hollywood. I was an actor to film school. I've always been intrigued with Hollywood. I directed a couple of films, and now I'm doing radio. So I'm going to try something that I never tried before. I don't know if it's going to work, and it may not work. But I'm going to give it a shot, because that's what I do. It'll be more broadcast kind of thing, but it's going to be a story. And here's a copy, Murder, He Wrote. I mean, how many times in your life have you ever been bullied or in a bad relationship? Even in a family fight, you said, I wish you were dead. Even worse, you might have said, I'm going to kill you. But you didn't do it. It was just angry talk. A human being can go from calm to rage if you press the right button to make a person turn into a murderer. Well, today we go back in time, 1921, Black Hollywood, a town full of corruption, sin, drugs, even murder. I want you to meet Roscoe Fetty Arbuckle. A lot of you guys don't know him, but your grandmothers may, or your great-grandmothers may, because we're going back in 1921. Fatty Arbuckle, Roscoe Conkling Fatty Arbuckle. He was born March 24th, 1887. 1887. Think about it. Think what was happening in 1887. What was happening in March 24th, 1887? You know, I wonder what headline was going on in 1887. Was there still slavery going on at the time? Was it? 1887. Just 1 minute. Think about this. And I'm going to find out what headlines were going on in 19 headlines. Here we go. In 1887. What was the headline in the newspaper in 1887? And what was happening then? They had the first Winchester gun in 1887. There was a nickel in 1887. And in the news, in the Herald in 1887, here, let's see, what was the headline? They're talking about real estate back then, auctions, and let's see what else. What was going on? There was a tanker that spilled 10.8 million gallons of oil. Elvis Presley was inducted. Well, it could be. No, Elvis Presley was inducted in 1958. So they're giving me all this kind of stuff. Anyway. But something also happened in 1987. It was the murder. Hollywood was doing silent films at the time. That's what was going on in 1887. But like I said, we're going to tell a story. That's when he was born. Fatty was born in March 24th, 1987, and he lived till June 29th, 1933. He was an American silent film actor. He was a comedian, director, and screenwriter. Started off at this entertainment company or musical company and eventually moved to Keystone Studios. Again, your grandmother might know about Keystone. That's where they had great silent film comedians, Mabel Normand, Harold Lloyd, and you might remember Harold Lloyd. That was a guy, it's a Hollywood icon poster where there's a guy with glasses and he's hanging by a clock in Hollywood. That was Harold Lloyd. He was a silent film actor. Charlie Chaplin, I'm sure you heard about him. Monty Banks, and of course, Bob Hope. Well, we're talking about Fatty. His life is about to be turned upside down. The story you're about to hear is true. The names were changed. The names were not changed because this shit did happen. And if you ever want to be interviewed by me, you can look at the marquee and hit that button and you can be interviewed by me. Melissa, thank you. Melissa, I want Melissa to get well. She is our morning crew. Melissa, am I broadcasting okay? Because I got my headset on and I can't hear the background, but thank you. Thank you for listening. I would say the number to come into the studio, but I kind of want to just do this as a podcast and just tell the story. I hope you guys don't mind. I'm doing this for the first time. I'm going to see if this works. Okay, here we go. Before we get to that, there's a real life murder that just happened. And you're not going to believe the story. And this just happened about 3:15 p.m. today. Before we get to Fatty Arbuckle, I want to just bring you to the present. Headline, suspected murderer of mom found dead in a duffel bag. The murderer texts her husband, your whole family is next. This just happened yesterday. Authorities are investigating a disturbing discovery of a body of a woman near her home in Queens. 50-year-old, her name is Orsolia. She was found in a duffel bag. She was stabbed 60 times. 60 times. Anybody can tell you, if anybody was stabbed 60 times, it sounds like it was a heat of passion kind of murder. Somebody probably she knew. I mean, I'm not a detective. I watch enough. Who would stab somebody 60 damn times? With her suspected killer on her loose, details have emerged that have left her family in fear for their safety. This happened yesterday. On top of that, Orsolia, Her husband reportedly received a text from her suspected killer after the murder. Authorities have reported heard information from the family of the woman about her final moments, and this is what happened. This is what happened. Yeah. The story is true. This happened yesterday. Ongoing investigation. This happened Saturday. This is all true. 8 a.m. Saturday morning. Her body was found in a duffel bag. On Saturday morning, around 8 a.m., a man found Gall's body stuffed inside a duffel bag. It was on a popular walking path on the corner of Metropolitan Avenue, Forest Park Drive. When police began looking for any clues, they found a blood trail leading away from the body that led to her house. Less than a half a mile away, her body was discovered. Right away, the police started to question the son. The police spoke to her 13-year-old son and learned that Gall's husband was out of state with a couple's 17-year-old son to look into colleges in Portland. Despite being a person of interest in the case, Gail's younger son was later released to an unspecified adult guardian. As of the time of this writing, no one else knows, no one else has been arrested, nobody knows anything in connection with the death of Osoya Gall. See, how do you stab a body 60 times? Yeah. I don't understand. It has to be passion. Well, according to the reports, Klein received a text, that's her husband, from the alleged killer saying, "Your whole family is next." It is believed that Gall went out to meet with some of her girlfriends but have returned home with a man around 11 p.m. who allegedly killed her in her basement before disposing of her body. There were no signs of forced entry at her home, leading police to believe that Gall willingly let the killer into her home. Yeah, that's what he did. At this time, there are still no questions, but people are still looking for answers regarding who's the killer. But police have indicated that the murderer may have been a male, that she knew him. Her son is reported to have been upstairs when the murder took place and was unaware of what happened. Yes. Detective reportedly discovered exchanges between Gull and three different men on her phone. Huh. One of them. Additionally, police obtained a surveillance video from the night Gull disappeared that appears to show the bag that Gall's body was later found in, being dragged down a sidewalk near her home by an unknown person. Many are horrified by the brutal killings, but police are just beginning their investigation. And they are looking for more evidence. Yes, they are. Mm-hmm. Including further surveillance video from the places that Gall might have visited on that night of her disappearance. There's related stories in Louisiana's Operation Fresh Start uncovers alleged sex trafficking ring. Only in Louisiana that there is a sex trafficking ring with 16 missing kids. That's a related story, but let's continue with this one. So you see, murder is alive and well, and that's just happened yesterday. Now, when we get back, our main story. Fatty Arbuckle, Hollywood's darling, comedian, silent movie star. People love this little fat bastard. But what happened to him is a tragedy. You're listening to Brian the Hammer Jackson. And today, Murder, He Wrote. And we'll be right back. Welcome back. Let's start with the beginning. Roscoe Arbuckle. Maybe I need a little help with the music right here. Let's do this. and maybe not. I wanted to get some really dramatic music here, and I did have it, and then I lost it. But it doesn't matter. I'll just tell the story its way it is. This started way back in, I think, 1940, but let's get this straight. Roscoe, here's the article, Roscoe Arbuckle. Little background. Let's go from the beginning. He was an American silent film actor. He was a comedian, director, screenwriter. He started at an entertainment company and eventually moved to Keystone Studios, where he worked with Mabel Normand, Harold Lloyd, Al St. John. He also he was a mentor to Charlie Chaplin, Monty Banks, and Bob Hope. He brought vaudeville star Buster Keaton into the movie business. So he was very influential. Arbuckle was one of the most popular silent stars of the 1910s and one of the highest paid actor in Hollywood. He signed a contract in 1920 with Paramount Pictures for $14,000. That's equivalent to $189,000 in 2021. Arbuckle was the defendant in three widely publicized trials between November 1921 and April 2022, for his alleged rape and manslaughter of actress Virginia Rape, R-A-P-P. Some people say rap, but I'm saying rape. She had fallen ill at a party hosted by Arbuckle in San Francisco, St. Francis Hotel, September 1921. And she died 4 days later. You know, I want this music. This is my show. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a little break, and I'm going to find that music, because I worked hard for it. Wait a minute. I think I got it. How's this? Wait a minute. How's this? Should be coming. There we go. Take two. There you go. A friend of rape, or rap, R-A-P-P-E, accused Arbuckle of raping and accidentally killing her. Yeah. The first two trials resulted in hung juries. But Keaton testified for the defense in a third trial, and he was acquitted, and acquitted Arbuckle. That's what it did. And the jury gave him a formal written statement of apology. Despite Arbuckle's acquittal, the scandal has mostly overshadowed his legacy as a pioneering comedian at the behest of Adolf Zucker. He was president of the famous Players Lansky. His films were banned by motion pictures industry. He was censored by Will H. Hayes after the trial, and he was publicly ostracized. Zucker was faced with the moral outrage of various groups such as the Lord's Day Alliance, the powerful Federation of Women's Club. Well, the women are at it again. And even the Federal Trade Commission to curb what they perceived as Hollywood's run amok, do what you want, bad morals on the general public. While Arbuckle saw a resurgence in his popularity immediately after his third trial, in which he was acquitted, Zucker decided he had to be sacrificed to keep the movie industry out of the clutches of censors and moralists. Hayes lifted the ban within a year, but Arbuckle only worked sparingly through the 1920s. Keaton made an agreement to give him 35% of his profit from Buster Keaton Comedy's company. He later worked as a film director under the pseudonym William Goodrich. He was finally able to return to acting, making short two-reel comedies in 1932 to 33. Arbuckle died in his sleep of a heart attack in 1933 at the age of 46, reportedly on the day he signed a contract with Warner Brothers to make a film. You know, here's the long and short of it. Yeah, look at that music. I don't know if they're going to go into details what happened, but let me get to the meat and potatoes. Here's what happened. On September 5th, 1921, Arbuckle took a break from his hectic film schedule. Let's get to the meat and potatoes. Despite suffering from second-degree burns to both buttocks from an onset accident, he drove to San Francisco with two friends, Lowell Sherman and Fred Fishback. The three checked into three rooms at the St. Francis Hotel, 1219, for Arbuckle and Fishback to share. These are the rooms. He was at 1219, another friend was at 1221, another friend was at 1220. These were designated as party rooms. Several women were invited to the suite during the carousing. A 26-year-old aspiring actress named Virginia Rape, or Rap, whatever. She was found seriously ill in room 1219 and was examined by the hotel doctor, who concluded her symptoms were mostly caused by intoxication, and he gave her morphine to calm her down. Rap, or Rape, was not hospitalized. Let's call it Rap. She was not hospitalized until 2 days after the incident. At the hospital, Rap's companion at the party, Bambine Ahmad Delmont, she told the doctor that Arbuckle had raped her friend. The doctor examined Rape but found no evidence of rape. She died 1 day later, after her hospitalization, caused by a ruptured bladder. You see, Rap suffered from chronic urinary tract infection. It's a condition that liquor irritated dramatically. She developed a reputation for over-embedding at a party and then drunkenly tearing at her clothes from the result of the physical pain. But by the time of the St. Francis Hotel party, her reproductive health was a greater concern. Delmont told police that Arbuckle had raped her. The police concluded that the impact of Arbuckle's overweight body lying on top of her, Rap, had eventually caused her bladder to rupture. At a later press conference, Rap's manager, Al Simnacker, he accused Arbuckle of using a piece of ice to simulate sex with Rap, thus leading her to her injuries. By the time the story was reported in newspapers, the object had evolved into a Coca-Cola or champagne bottle rather than a piece of ice. In fact, witnesses testified that Arbuckle rubbed the ice on Rap's stomach to ease her abdominal pain. Arbuckle denied any wrongdoing. Delmont later made a statement incriminating Arbuckle to the profile in an attempt to extort money from Arbuckle's attorney. Arbuckle's trial was a major media event. The story was fueled by yellow journalism, with the newspapers portraying Arbuckle as a gross lecherer who used his weight to overpower innocent girls. William Randolph Hearst, remember him? The national newspaper chain exploited the situation and exaggerated and sensationalized stories. Hearst was gratified by the profits he accrued during the Arbuckle scandal, and later said that he had sold more newspapers than any event ever since the sinking of the Titanic. Huh. Morally, groups called for Arbuckle to be sentenced to death. The resulting scandal destroyed Arbuckle's career along with his personal life. Arbuckle was regarded by those who knew him closely as a good-natured man who was shy around women. He has been described as the most honest and caring man in pictures. However, studio executive, fearing negative publicity by association, ordered Arbuckle's industry friends and fellow actors, whose careers they controlled, not to publicly speak up for him. Charlie Chaplin, who was in Britain at the time, told reporters that he could not and would not believe Arbuckle had anything to do with Braff's death. Having known Arbuckle since they both worked at Keystone in 1914, Chaplin knew Roscoe to be a gentle, easygoing type who would not harm a fly. Buster Keaton reportedly did make one public statement in support of Arbuckle's innocence, a decision which earned him a mild reprimand from the studios where he worked. Film actor William S. Hart, who had never met or worked with Arbuckle, made a number of damaging public statements in which he presumed that Arbuckle was guilty. Arbuckle later wrote a premise for a film parodying Hart as a thief, bully, and white beater, which Keaton purchased from him. The resulting film, The Frozen North, was released in 1922, almost a year after the scandal first emerged. Keaton co-wrote, directed, and starred in the picture. Consequently, Hart refused to speak to Keaton for many years. So here's what happened. Arbuckle did not rape her. He was rubbing ice on her stomach because she had abdominal pain. They took her to the hospital. The doctor said there's no evidence of rape here. But that woman claimed there was rape. This was way back in the 1930s and the 40s. Have things changed? It has not changed since then. How many directors, how many actors to this day have been accused? And their careers ended by the same kind of people, the feminists and hashtag Me Too, who's out for glory, money, fame, relevance. I'm just want to be in the newspaper, and they have destroyed people's careers. It has not changed since then. This poor bastard, Fatty Arbuckle, was a comedian, a gentle soul. He tried to help somebody, but then again, somebody saw an opportunity, and they destroyed this man. Then Hollywood. Hollywood tends to shit on its own. Hollywood will shit on you. You chase the dream, you chase the goal, you chase whatever, but Hollywood is an unforgiving bitch. It will eat you up. It will rip your heart out. All for profit. This poor bastard, on September 17, 1921, Arbuckle was arrested and arraigned on charges of manslaughter. He arranged bail after nearly 3 weeks in jail. The trial began November 14, 1921. It was in a courthouse in San Francisco. Arbuckle hired as his lead defense counsel, Gavin McNabb. He was a competent local attorney. The principal witness was Previn. At the beginning of the trial, Arbuckle told his already estranged wife, Minta Darfey, that he did not harm Rapp. She believes him and appeared regularly in a courtroom to support him. Public feeding was so negative that Darfey was later shot while entering the courthouse. She was shot. This is his ex-wife who was supporting him, and when she entered the courthouse, she was shot. Brady's first witness during the trial included Betty Campbell, a model who attended the party and testified that she saw Arbuckle with a smile on his face hours after the alleged rape occurred. Great Houston, a local hospital nurse who testified it was very likely that Arbuckle raped Rapp and bruised her body in the press in the process. A nurse. And Dr. Edward Hendrick, a local criminologist who claimed that the fingerprints on the door to the hallway proved that Rapp had tried to flee, but that Arbuckle had stopped her by putting his hand over hers. Dr. Arthur Birdsley, the hotel doctor who had examined Rapp, testified that an external force seemed to have damaged her bladder during cross-examination. However, Campbell revealed that Brady had threatened to charge her with perjury if she did not testify against Arbuckle. All this conspiracy. Dr. Hendrick claimed to have found fingerprints was cast into doubt after McNabb produced a maid from the St. Francis Hotel who testified that she had thoroughly cleaned the room before the investigation took place. Dr. Beardsley admitted that Rapp had never mentioned being assaulted while he was treating her. McNabb was further able to get Nurse Holston to admit that the rapture of Rapp's bladder could very well have been a result of cancer, and that the bruises on her body could have been a result of very heavy jewelry she was wearing that evening. A conspiracy happens. On November 28th, Arbuckle testified as the defense final witness. He was simple, direct, unflustered, and in both direct and cross-examination. In his testimony, Arbuckle claimed that Rapp, whom he testified, he had known for 5-6 years. She came into the party room around noon that day, and that sometimes afterwards he went to his room 2019 to change clothes after Maytub, the daughter-in-law of Billy Sunday, asked him for a ride into town in his room. Arbuckle discovered Rapp in the bathroom vomiting into a toilet. He then claimed Rapp told him she felt ill and asked to lie down, and that he carried her into the bedroom and asked a few of the party guests to help treat her. When Arbuckle and a few of the guests re-entered the room, they found Rapp on the floor near the bed, tearing at her clothing and going into violent convulsions. To calm Rapp down, they placed her in a bathtub of cold water. Arbuckle and Fishback then took her to room 1227 and called the hotel manager and doctor. At this point, all those present thought Rapp was just very drunk, including the hotel doctors, probably assuming Rapp would just simply sleep it off. Arbuckle drove Tab into town. During the whole trial, the prosecution presented medical descriptions of Rapp's bladder as evidence that she had an illness. In his testimony, Arbuckle denied that he had any knowledge of Rapp's illness during cross-examination. The assistant district attorney, Leo Friedman, aggressively grilled Arbuckle over the fact that he refused to call a doctor when he found Rapp sick, and argued that he refused to do so because he knew of Rapp's illness and saw a perfect opportunity to rape and kill her. Arbuckle calmly maintained that he never physically hurt or sexually assaulted Rapp in any way during the party, and he also stated that he never made any inappropriate sexual advances against any woman in his life. After 2 weeks of testimony with 60 prosecution and defense witnesses, including 18 doctors who testified about Rapp's illness, the defense rested on December 4, 1921. The jury returned 5 days later, and they were deadlocked. After nearly 44 hours of deliberation, with a 10-2 not guilty verdict, and a mistrial was declared. Arbuckle's attorney later concentrated their attention on one woman's name, Helen Hubbard, who had told jurors that she would vote guilty until hell freezes over. She refused to look at the exhibits or read the trial transcripts. Having made up her mind in a courtroom, Hubbard's husband was a lawyer who did business with the DA's office and expressed surprise that she was not challenged when she was selected for the jury pool. While much attention was paid to Hubbard after the trial, some former jury members told reporters that they believed that Arbuckle was indeed guilty, but not beyond a reasonable doubt. During the deliberation, some jurors joined Hubbard on voting to convict, but they all recanted except for Thomas Kilkenny. Arbuckle's researchers joined Joan Myers, described the political climate and the media attention to the presence of women on juries, which had only begun legal for 4 years at the time, and how Arbuckle's defense immediately singled out Hubbard as a villain. So you see, Myers also records Hubbard's account of the jury foreman August Fritz's attempt to bully her into changing her vote to not guilty, while Hubbard's offered explanations on her vote whether change. They remained silent, and they quickly faded from the spotlight. The trial ended. So you can see the politics, the money, the scandal, an innocent man. His career was ruined by somebody just saying something. Extortion, money, Hollywood. And it should have ended there. But there was a second trial, and then there was a third trial. And I'm going to skip. By the time they get to the third trial, Arbuckle's films have been banned. Newspapers have been filled for the past 7 months with stories of Hollywood orgies, murder, and sexual perversion. Delmont was touring the country, giving one woman's show as the woman who signed the murder charge against Arbuckle, and lecturing on the evils of Hollywood. You remember Delmont? She was the one who accused him at the hospital. The third trial began March 13, 1922. At this time, the defense took no chances. McNabb took an aggressive defense, completely tearing apart the prosecutor's case with long and aggressive examination and cross-examination of each witness. McNabb also managed to get in still more evidence about Rapp's lurid past and medical history. Another hole in the prosecution's case was open because Previn, a key witness, was out of the country after fleeing police custody and unable to testify, as in the first trial. Arbuckle testified as the final witness, and again maintained his denials and his heartfelt testimony about the versions of the events at the party. Buster Keene is said to have been in the courtroom and provided important evidence to prove Arbuckle's innocence. Delmont was involved in prostitution, extortion, and blackmail. This was the woman who claimed Arbuckle raped her friend at the hospital. And later they found that she was a prostitute, extortion, and blackmail during the closing statements. McNabb reviewed how flawed the case was against Arbuckle from the very start and how Brady fell for the outlandish charge of Delmont, who McNabb described as a complaining witness who never witnessed. The jury began deliberations April 12th and took only 6 minutes. 6 minutes to return with a unanimous not guilty verdict. Five of those minutes were spent writing a formal statement of apology to Arbuckle for putting him through the ordeal. A dramatic move in American justice, the jury statement as read by the jury as follows. We should take a break. But I don't think we should. But no, we're too close. And this is what the jury wrote. Acquittal is not enough for Roscoe Arbuckle. We feel that a great injustice has been done to him. We feel also that it was only our plain duty to give him exoneration. Under the evidence, there was not the slightest proof to connect him in any way with the commission of a crime. He was mainly throughout the case and told a straightforward story on the witness stand, which we all believe. The happening at the hotel was an unfortunate affair for which Arbuckle, so the evidence shows, was in no way responsible. We wish him success and hope that the American people will take the judgment of 14 men and a woman who have sat listening for 31 days to evidence that Roscoe Arbuckle entirely innocent and free from all blame. You know, after reading the apology statement, the jury foreman personally handed the statement to Arbuckle, who kept it as a memento for the rest of his life. Then one by one, 12-person jury plus the two jury alternates walked up to Arbuckle's defense table, where they shook his hand and embraced and personally apologized to him. The entire jury proudly posed with Arbuckle for a photograph after the verdict and the apology. Some expert later concluded that Raft's bladder might have ruptured as a result of an abortion she might have had a short time before the party. Her organs had been displayed, and it was now impossible to test for pregnancy. Because alcohol was consumed at the party, Arbuckle was forced to plead guilty to one count of violating the Volstead Act and had to pay a $500 fine. At the time of his acquittal, he owed over $700,000, equivalent to approximately $11 million in 2021. That's just his legal fees to his attorneys for three criminal trials, and he was forced to sell his house and all of his cars to pay some of the debt. The scandal and trials have greatly damaged Arbuckle's popularity among the general public. In spite of the acquittal and the apology, his reputation was not restored, and the effect of the scandal continue. William H. Hayes, who served as the head of the newly formed Motion Picture Producers and Distribution of America and the Censor Board, cited Arbuckle as an example of poor morals in Hollywood. On April 18, 1922, 6 days after Arbuckle's acquittal, Hayes banned him from ever working in the U.S. movies again. He had also requested that all showing and bookings of Arbuckle films be canceled the same year. Under public pressure, Hayes elected to lift the ban. However, Arbuckle was still unable to secure work as an actor. Most people declined to hire Arbuckle, and they still censored his films. Paramount declined to release in the U.S. owing to the scandal, was eventually released in Europe, with Arbuckle's films now banned in March 1922. Keaton signed an agreement to give Arbuckle 35% of the future profits from his production company, Buster Keaton Comedies, in hope of easing his financial situation. There you go. But it was a sad, sad thing. I think he died. Well, I don't have to think. It's right here. In November 1923, Minta Duffy filed for divorce from Arbuckle, charging grounds of desertion. The divorce was granted the following January. They had been separated since 1921. Though Duffy always claimed he was the nicest man in the world and they were still friends, after a brief reconciliation, Duffy again filed for divorce, this time in Paris, December 1924. Arbuckle married Doris Dean on May 16, 1925. Arbuckle tried returning to film, but industry resistance to distributing, and his pictures continued to linger after his acquittal. He retreated into alcoholism. In the words of his first wife, Roscoe only seemed to find solace and comfort in the bottle. Keaton attempted to help Arfoco by giving him work on his friends. Arfoco wrote the story for a Keaton short called Daydreams. Arfoco allegedly co-directed scenes in Keaton's Sherlock Jr., 1924, but it was unclear how much this footage remained in the film's final cut. In 1925, Carter DeHaven's short character studies shot before the scandal was released. Arbuckle appeared alongside Keaton, Harold Lloyd, Rudolph Valentino, Douglas Fairbanks, and Jackie Coogan. The same year, the photoplay in August issue it came out. This is a sad, sad story, and it still happens today. That's my version of what happened. This is the movie version, what happened. And when we come back, you'll hear it. What's the moral of the story? The moral of the story is that even today, with allegations, people's careers are ruined. Lies are said. Hollywood trying to defend themselves, saying that they're moral entertainment company. And they would sacrifice people to put that propaganda in your face. We can go as far as the current slap with Will Smith to Chris Rock. They let a man sit there as he assaulted another man, sit there, only in Hollywood. That after a man assaults another man, then he gets a standing ovation for winning some kind of award that doesn't mean anything as the best actor. Only in Hollywood. Dirty, dirty, dirty place. And we'll come back. You heard my story. You'll hear somebody else's story about Fatty Arbuckle. It's a sad thing. We'll be right back. I think I need a beer.
When I got the news today, I didn't know what to say, so I just hung up the phone. I took a walk to clear my head. This is where the walk-in led. Can't believe you're really gone. Don't feel like going home, so I'm gonna sit right here on the edge of this pier and watch the sunset disappear. And drink a beer. Funny how the good ones go too soon, but the good Lord knows the reasons why, yeah. Sometimes a greater plan is kind of hard to understand. Right now it don't make sense. I can't make it all make sense, so I'm gonna say on the edge of this field, watch the sunset disappear. Drink a beer. So long, my friend, until we that we used to. and drink a beer. Drink a beer. Drink a beer.
I told you the story how I saw it, and here's how Hollywood would tell the story of Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle.
A 100 years ago, this September, a Labor Day party at a hotel in San Francisco led to the death of a young woman and to the arrest of one of Hollywood's biggest stars on a charge of murder. It's always difficult, in the case of murder, to establish the exact facts, and it's especially difficult where the person involved is a very influential or very famous or very important one. This is my consideration of what happened at that party on the 5th of September, 1921. In early September 1921, three friends from the motion picture industry in Hollywood motored up the coast to San Francisco. They were in high spirits because a weekend Labor Day party had been arranged, and although the strictures of prohibition were intended to curb such activities as drinking alcohol, it was more honored in the breach than in its observance. The three friends were stars in the movie industry, and the biggest of these, figuratively and literally, was the man at the wheel of the car, Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle himself. From his instantly recognizable outsized physique, weighing 266 pounds, and slapstick comedic talent, he had carved himself a huge slice of the pie, and was second only to Charlie Chaplin in terms of earnings. In fact, he had just signed a contract for 3 years with Paramount Pictures for $1 million a year. That's nearly $20 million a year in 2021 terms. He was accompanied on this trip by his friends Fred Fishback and Lowell Sherman, both successful actor-directors. They had hired a suite of 3 rooms at the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco for the Labor Day party. Room 1219 was Arbuckle's room. Another was actor Lowell Sherman's, and a third room was to be used for the party. About 25 people attended, and things started well enough. A Victrola gramophone played the crackling acoustic recordings of the jazz age. People danced. Smoke hung thick and blew in the air, and the sound of laughter was liberal amongst them. Everyone drank too much, and of course there was no shortage of young starlets, anxious to get a part in movies or advance their careers, all attractive, eager, and willing. Amongst the slew of girls attending the extended party was one who stood out from the rest, a 30-year-old woman, she claimed to be 26, called Virginia Rappe. She arrived at around 10:30 a.m. with a friend, Bambina Maud Delmont.
Rappe.
Rappe was a woman who caught the eye. Of considerable beauty, she had been born out of wedlock to Mabel Rapp in 1891 and raised by her grandmother in Chicago, her mother having died when Virginia was young. She was a bright, ambitious girl, and blessed with extraordinary good looks and figure, she added an E to the end of her name to lend it a certain cachet and became a model, a successful one too. Given her looks and figure, how could she not be? She was soon earning around $4,000 a year, about $120,000 in 2021.
Her form and face graced the covers of magazines coast to coast and beyond. She modeled in Paris and London. In 1915, she became engaged to a fashion designer called Robert Moskowitz, but he died in a streetcar accident, and thereafter she pursued her own career as a dress designer. During the war, she was known for her striking designs, often white and with a peace theme. It was perhaps inevitable such a woman would eventually gravitate to the new moving picture industry, and by 1920 she had carved out a successful career for herself as an actress, having recently starred in a short film. She had acted with Rudolph Valentino also, and was a friend of Charlie Chaplin's wife Mildred. Naturally, she had been voted the best-dressed girl in pictures, too. She was. By 1917, she was engaged to the actor and director Henry Lehrman, a major player in Hollywood who had directed a number of Chaplin and Arbuckle movies, and he may have introduced her to Arbuckle. She had small parts in Arbuckle movies from 1917 on and attracted his attention. Arbuckle loved attractive women. He sent her gifts, including, it was reported, a gold watch inscribed to her. He was much taken with her. At the time of the fateful party, Lehrman and Rappé had quarreled, and he had gone to New York. Rappé was rather anxious about this breach with her fiancé, but she was a woman on the up and up. If not quite Hollywood royalty yet, she was a woman with a future. Well, perhaps she was. The exact facts are, as ever in such cases, in dispute, but it is clear that early in the afternoon on the 5th of September 1921, Roscoe Arbuckle, wearing pajamas, was in his bedroom with Virginia Rappé, and the door was locked. At some point afterwards, Virginia Rappé's friend, Maud Delmont, heard a scream, became concerned, and went and knocked on the door. Receiving no reply, she tried the handle, and finding it was locked, she began to kick it and shout to be let in. Unable to get an answer, and Virginia Rappé having been closeted in the room alone with Arbuckle for about 30 minutes, she sent for the hotel assistant manager, Harry Boyle. At length, Arbuckle appeared at the door in his pajamas and wearing Virginia Rappé's green-banded white Panama hat, set on his head at a rakish angle. On the bed behind him lay a semi-naked Virginia Rappé, moaning in some distress. The guests rushed in, and thinking she was drunk, Rappé was stripped naked and placed in a tub of cold water before being removed to her own room by Arbuckle and Fred Fishback. Her friend, Maud Delmont, called a doctor to attend to her. Dr. Olaf Carbo, followed by Dr. Arthur Beardsley, saw the ill woman and were both told by Maud Delmont that Virginia had been raped by Arbuckle. But neither of them seems to have taken Delmont's claims of rape seriously or seen any sign of it, and both thought she was merely drunk. Increasingly frustrated, Delmont called a third doctor, Dr. Melville Rumwell, and she told him that a drunk Arbuckle had dragged Virginia into his bedroom, sexually assaulted her, and that this was responsible for her present condition. Virginia Rappé deteriorated in the next 48 hours. She was admitted to hospital on the 7th of September, and here she died 2 days later, on the 9th of September, 1921. Maud Delmont decided to go to the police. She informed them that Virginia Rappé had told her that Arbuckle had raped her. A police investigation began. These are the facts upon which the case was predicated. Beyond this, there is a great deal of confusion and obfuscation, much of it by design, and little agreement. Every fact claimed on one side has its equal and opposite counterfact on the other. Roscoe Conkling Arbuckle was born on March the 24th, 1887, in Smith Center, Kansas, one of 9 children. When he was just 2 years old, his family moved to Santa Ana, California, and he was on stage from the age of 8. His mother died when he was 11, and he graduated to singing. Apparently, he had a good voice, and then to a vaudeville career as a comedian. In 1908, he married actress Minta Durfee, and the following year he made some short movies, initially with the Selig Polyscope Company, and then, following a brief stint with Universal Studios, he settled with Paramount. The new silent moving pictures were ideal for his kind of visual humor. He had a great talent for making people laugh, and in spite of his size, a certain grace in his movements. The camera liked him, and he was soon commanding huge salaries as Fatty Arbuckle. With success came the perks of money and power, and he learned how to live well, and was known for it. He bought a Pierce Arrow motor car for $8,000 in 1919, and spent a further $25,000, that's about $400,000 today, on customizing it to include a concealed bar, ideal for transporting liquor in those prohibition years. He also bought Theda Barra's old house in West Adams Boulevard for $250,000, about $4 million today, and spent a further fortune in refurbishing it to his taste. He dressed flamboyantly in loud checkered suits, liked parties, food, and alcohol, and wherever he went, women were never in short supply. An autopsy on the body of Virginia Rappe revealed that she had died from a ruptured bladder, and that this had been caused as a result of great pressure being applied to her abdomen. The bladder was inflamed too, and acute peritonitis was present, but no pathological change was found to have been present prior to its being ruptured, which implied that the rupture had initiated her other conditions. There was also extensive bruising to her thighs and arms noted. Police suspicions focused immediately on Arbuckle. Maud Delmont, who attended the party with Virginia Rappe, and who called the hotel manager and doctors and had her friend admitted to hospital, claimed Virginia had told her that Roscoe did this to me. Delmont was not the most reliable witness, had a distinctly checkered background, but was nevertheless quite insistent regarding her story. Another girl at the party, Alice Blake, a chorus girl, confirmed her story. She told police that Virginia had told her the following day, "Roscoe hurt me." And a starlet called Zay Prevost also told authorities that Virginia Rappe had said, "I am dying. He did it." Police took statements from those present at the party, examined the hotel suite, and on the 11th of September, Arbuckle was arrested and charged with the murder of Virginia Rappe. An inquest into Virginia's death was held, at which a nurse at the Wakefield Sanatorium, where Virginia had been taken, told the coroner, Thomas Leland, that Virginia Rappe had told her that improper relations occurred with Arbuckle, but she did not indicate whether or not these had been consensual. She said Virginia had been particularly anxious that her fiancé, Henry Lehrman, should not find out about this. Al Semnicker, a close friend of Arbuckle's, and also Virginia's manager, told the inquest that Virginia had told him the following day Roscoe had hurt her. Delmont gave evidence that Arbuckle had pulled Virginia Rappe into his bedroom, saying, "I've waited for you for 5 years, and now I've got you." She also said he then closed the door. After about 30 minutes, Delmont said she called Harry Boyle, the hotel assistant manager, and he arrived and called to Arbuckle, who then opened the door. He was dressed in his pajamas and wearing Virginia Rappe's Panama hat at a comical angle. It was established at inquest that everyone had rushed in to see what was happening. Virginia was lying semi-naked on the bed and obviously distressed. She was tearing at her clothes and screaming in pain, according to witnesses. Arbuckle had told her to shut up or I'll throw you out of the window. The evidence was mounting, but it was all disputed, especially the results of the autopsy, and many of the guests claimed not to remember what had occurred. To clarify matters, the coroner's physician, Dr. Shelby Strange, conducted a second autopsy, and he confirmed the dead woman's injuries were caused by great external force being applied to her abdomen. He also noted bruising to her right upper arm, which appeared to have been caused by the deep impression of fingers. Matthew Brady, the district attorney, concluded that Arbuckle had indeed raped Rappe, as Delmont had claimed. He and Alice Blake, Al Semnicker, Vera Cumberland and a woman called Zay Prevost had further claimed Roscoe had hurt her. Therefore seemed conclusive that Arbuckle's great weight had been responsible for her injuries. But Arbuckle told a very different story to that of Delmont and others. In fact, he told several different stories before settling on one. Initially, he said he had a few drinks with Rapet in his room. She complained she could not breathe and tore off all her clothes. He said others were in the room at the time, and they had thought she was drunk and put her in the bath. Then two women at the party took her to her own room. But Arbuckle later adapted his story to admit he had been locked in his room alone with Rapet, but only for a short time, he said, and that he had found her there vomiting when he went into the room. Matthew Brady and his team were skeptical of this. But Brady had a problem. His chief witness, Maud Delmont, was hardly a woman whose character could stand the scrutiny of a skilled defense lawyer, nor could those of any of his other witnesses. These were not people of outstanding probity, and whatever it was claimed Virginia Rapet had told various people, it was hearsay. The only people who knew what had happened in the locked room of 1219 on the 5th of September were Roscoe Arbuckle and Virginia Rapet, and one of these was dead. But the accounts heard were suggestive, and the coroner's jury gave its verdict as manslaughter against Arbuckle. In spite of this, Brady decided to press ahead and charge Arbuckle with murder. Under California's civil code, it was provided that if life was taken during the commission of an offense, it should be regarded as murder. Therefore, even if Virginia Rapet's death was not intended, the fact that it was caused as a result of the commission of another offense, i.e. rape, would make it murder. At preliminary hearings at the police court, a judge rejoicing in the name of Sylvain Lazarus decided the charge against Arbuckle should be one of manslaughter. District Attorney Brady had little choice but to accept that with a coroner's jury and police court determining there was not sufficient evidence to go after a murder charge, he would be forced to proceed with the lesser one. Arbuckle was therefore bailed once the charge was reduced to one of manslaughter. He had reason to be satisfied. The offense of manslaughter carried a maximum sentence of only 10 years, compared to that of murder, for which the penalty was death. The arrest for murder and subsequent charges for manslaughter of one of the greatest stars of the movies naturally created world headlines, and the newspaper industry, which feeds off sensation, had some of the most lurid headlines they could possibly have dreamed of. William Randolph Hearst, the press mogul, whose newspapers dominated America at that time, according to Buster Keaton, later said that the Arbuckle affair had sold more newspapers than any other event since the sinking of the Lusitania by a German U-boat in 1915. There is no doubt it shocked America, and it shocked the world's reading public too, because the movie phenomenon had reached into the homes and lives of people throughout the developed world. There was a great deal of public anger directed at Arbuckle as the circumstances became known, and much of this was innuendo and lurid speculation, but caused great damage. Meanwhile, Brady was becoming increasingly concerned at what he believed to be efforts made by Arbuckle's friends and others working for the defense to intimidate or buy off witnesses, and he decided to request that Betty Campbell and Alice Blake be placed under 24-hour police protection. The trial of Roscoe Arbuckle began on the 14th of November 1921 before Judge Harold Lauderbach. Arbuckle was defended by Gavin McNabb, a highly successful lawyer, with Matthew Brady, DA, and Leo Friedman, his deputy, appearing for the state. Arbuckle and his advisers took a two-handed approach to his defense. One was to attack the state witnesses, people like Delmont, who had initiated the police complaint, and here there was, naturally, much to attack. These were people whose lives were shocking to ordinary American folk, people whose mode of living and habits were far removed from their own. The other approach was to supply witnesses who were willing to give a different version of events, one more favorable to Arbuckle. The prosecution case was that Arbuckle had attended a party whose principal purpose was for the indulgence of the sexual appetites of the star and his friends. He had lusted after Virginia Rappe, may even have lured her there with promises of career advancement. Whatever the case, he had taken her to his room that afternoon, where he had locked the door and raped her. As a result of that rape, and his considerable weight and bulk, he had caused her injuries which had resulted in her death 4 days later. The defense was simply that there was no evidence to prove that this is what had occurred, and to show that Miss Rappe had suffered from a bladder condition which had precipitated her illness and led to her death. Arbuckle and others had done what they could for Rappe, claimed the defense, but owing to no fault of his, she had died of injuries which had nothing to do with him. The prosecution soon ran into trouble. The defense had dug deep for dirt on Maud Delmont and found something. She was bigamously married. It was a blow for the prosecution, as it seriously tarnished her character as a witness. She could not be called. She had effectively been neutralized as a witness. But it was not plain sailing for Arbuckle's team either. There was much evidence heard of an oblique kind which damaged Arbuckle. Betty Campbell, a model, testified she had spent most of the Labor Day party fighting off the unwanted advances of his friend Lowell Sherman. Apparently Sherman had called her into his bedroom, and when she went, had slammed the door behind her and locked it. Outside, she could hear everyone laughing about this. She ran into the bathroom and locked the door behind her. He continued to try to gain access to her, but at length he gave up, and she managed to escape. But as she did so, Arbuckle's other friend, Freddy Fishback, tried to push her back into the room again. She said, "I shut the door on him and later got out to safety." Such revelations of the predatory, rapacious nature of Arbuckle and his two friends were profoundly shocking, and the press reported them with barely concealed glee. The medical evidence was itself equivocal. Dr. William Ophuls, who performed the initial autopsy, found no signs of violence nor of illness to Miss Rappe. She was a healthy young woman, he said. His report vindicated both defense and prosecution. Dr. Beardsley, too, testified that the ruptured bladder had been caused by external force, but he said there was no sign of rape. Other witnesses were more helpful to the prosecution case. A nurse, referring to bruises and injuries Rappe had received, thought they gave the appearance of her having been raped, and Zay Prevost, whose real name was Sadie Rice, said she heard Rappe say Roscoe had hurt her. Dr. Edward Heinrich, a fingerprint expert, discovered Virginia Rappe's fingerprints on the door, over which Arbuckle's were overlaid in a manner that suggested his hand had been placed over hers. He believed this indicated that she had attempted to escape Arbuckle, but had been prevented from doing so. The defense was able to mitigate or lessen the effect of these, and introduce elements of uncertainty, even claiming that Rappe's heavy jewelry accounted for the bruising on her body. But there was something shocking, something that was to become memorable and infamous in the case, yet to come. Arbuckle's friend and Virginia's manager, Al Semnicker, called to the witness stand, with obvious reluctance and a great deal of prevarication, agreed that he had been present at the party and was present at a discussion involving Arbuckle and his friends the following day, at which they had discussed the events of the party. He constantly claimed he could not remember events, but at length he made a slip. Brady asked him, "Did Arbuckle say anything at the time about a piece of ice?" It was out of the blue, and Semnicker was clearly flustered. He said at last, "He did." "What did he say?" "He told us he had placed a piece of ice on Miss Rappe." "On?" queried Brady. Semnicker, following a long pause, said, "No." "Well, exactly what did Arbuckle say?" demanded Brady. "I don't want to use his words," said the unhappy Semnicker. "I insist they are important," continued the DA. Still, Semnicker would not say. "Well, whisper them to the court reporter," Brady suggested. Semnicker did, and these were written down and conveyed to council. Arbuckle sat stone-faced, his wife, Minta Durfee, rigid by his side, who was separated from him, but who consistently played the part of loving wife throughout the proceedings, turned away from him. She looked distressed. Pressed by counsel, Semnicker said when Arbuckle recounted this anecdote concerning the ice to the male company on that occasion, all those present laughed. Further pressed, he could not recall who had laughed, or whether he himself had laughed, and could not say who did. It was a general thing, he said. There is little doubt that the story of the ice, which in popular urban mythology would become a Coca-Cola bottle or champagne bottle, is untrue. But it seems probable that Arbuckle did tell the anecdote concerning the ice to the male company that day as a distasteful joke. How he must have regretted it. Semnicker's testimony, extremely damaging to Arbuckle, was all the more potent because it was drawn from him most unwillingly, and the response of Arbuckle's defense was to blacken Semnicker's name and character and to claim he was in conspiracy with Delmont and others. In truth, Semnicker had divided loyalties towards his deceased client and his friend Arbuckle. Arbuckle took the stand on the 28th of November. He stated he had known Virginia Rappet for 5 or 6 years and said, "When I walked into 1219, I closed the door and locked it, and I went to the bathroom where I found Miss Rappet on the floor in front of the toilet. She'd been vomiting." He said he had carried her to the bed and laid her on it. He said he went to get help, and when he returned, he found Miss Rappet tearing off her clothes. Mrs. Delmont rubbed ice on her stomach, he claimed, and they put her in a tub of cold water because she was hysterical. Then he and Fred Fishback carried her to her own room. He stuck to this story, in which he was clearly well-drilled, and kept his nerve impressively in the face of aggressive and provocative cross-examination by Assistant D.A. Friedman. Lowell Sherman was less effective. He took the witness stand and tried to make light of the party. It was, he said, just a few old friends chatting. Brady was quick upon him like a fox. "A few old friends?" he queried. "What did you think when Virginia Rappet was carried out screaming?" "I thought she was drunk," he replied. He admitted he had been present when she had all of her remaining clothes removed from her, and Brady inquired, "Is it customary for men at a party to take a girl's clothes off and for other men to watch, even if she's drunk? Wouldn't you say that that is more than just a couple of good friends chatting?" At the very least, Arbuckle and his friends looked like callous voyeurs. The jury, after long and arduous deliberation, which lasted 44 hours, were deadlocked. A unanimous decision was required, and they could reach only a 10-2 majority for not guilty. A mistrial was therefore called. There would be a fresh trial. Nevertheless, Arbuckle's attorneys issued a statement claiming that had it not been for a single woman juror, Mrs. Helen Hubbard, who had been intransigent and unreasonable, he would have been acquitted and exonerated. It was a falsehood. There was another juror who had held out in the final 22nd ballot of the jurors and voted Arbuckle guilty. It also emerged that other jurors thought Arbuckle guilty too, but that they thought the evidence was insufficient to warrant a conviction. Helen Hubbard was nevertheless vilified, and numerous attacks were made on her by Arbuckle's attorneys and by those employed to shore up the public relations aspect of the trial for him. The case was heard again on the 11th of January, 1922. For trial number 2, the prosecution and defense and their teams were unchanged. Judge Louderback again oversaw proceedings, but now the defense placed increased emphasis on the dissolute life and character of Virginia Rappet, and greater claims still were made concerning her medical history. The defense got off to a flying start. A string of witnesses attested to Virginia Rappet having suffered severe abdominal pain after drinking alcohol on previous occasions, and this, they said, was frequently accompanied by her tearing her clothes off. It seemed suggestive, but D.A. Matthew Brady, sensing foul play, discovered that one of the witnesses making such claims, Minnie Neighbors, had lied. Virginia Rappe had never been at her hotel, and as a result, Minnie Neighbors was charged with perjury. Another witness was also found to be lying, and a third was found to be a friend of Arbuckle's. In addition, four people were discovered to have offered their services of giving false evidence to the defense counsel for money. The defense did not deny these, but said they had not accepted the offers. The prosecution countered these claims by calling old friends of Virginia's to testify that she had never suffered any illnesses of the bladder, did not have alcohol sensitivity, nor did she exhibit the conduct the defense attributed to her of tearing off her clothes after drinking. In addition, the prosecution pointed out that no medical history of Virginia's alluded to bladder infections, and one feminine ailment she had suffered 8 years prior to her death was a common one and had no bearing on the matter. And in any case, three doctors appointed by the court to examine Virginia's organs concluded that there was no constitutional weakness or pre-existing complaint, whatever other random doctors recruited for such a purpose could be persuaded to claim. Additional evidence for the prosecution was presented in the form of a security guard at Culver Studios, who said that some time before, Arbuckle had tried to bribe him with cash to give him the key to Virginia Rappe's dressing room. He had refused, but Zay Prevost and other witnesses had, curiously, changed their mind, now denying earlier damning testimonies. They also claimed that the prosecution had forced them to make the earlier statements. Dr. Heinrich was now less certain of his declaration concerning the Arbuckle-Rappe fingerprints on the door. He admitted they could be faked. A maid was called by the defense, who said she had thoroughly cleaned the door of room 1219. It must all have seemed rather curious to the jury, if not suspicious. The prosecution had great difficulty in rounding up its witnesses to testify. There was undoubtedly a fear amongst them that their careers would be damaged by doing so. Several were warned or bribed by Arbuckle's friends. Betty Campbell, who had changed her evidence to state the exact opposite of that she had originally claimed, admitted she had been approached by Hollywood figures to do so, but denied she had been paid $50,000 for this. By the end of the trial, Arbuckle's attorney, McNabb, was so confident of acquittal, he deigned to reply to the prosecution case. He was mistaken. Perhaps it was as a result of this, or possibly because the jury found the disappearance of prosecution witnesses and the obvious reversals of testimonies too much to swallow, that 15 hours of deliberation again resulted in a hung jury. This time for a 10-2 guilty verdict against Arbuckle. Once again, a mistrial was called, and the case presented for trial a third time. The third trial commenced on the 13th of March, 1922. The same judge, Louderback, sat on the bench for a final weary time. The defense and prosecution counsels were as before. This trial was different, though. It was a confusion of people who had sworn one thing and now changed their minds, of bad-tempered accusations and counter-accusations by prosecutors and defense counsel. The defense launched an unbridled attack on Virginia Rappe. She drank excessively, it claimed. She had abdominal problems. She was promiscuous. She got drunk at parties and stripped off. It was even hinted that she had an illegitimate child she had abandoned, and numerous miscarriages. Its approach seemed to have evolved into one which relied largely on throwing as much mud as possible at the dead woman, in the sure knowledge that some, perhaps most of it, would stick. And in this they were successful. They attacked Maud Delmont, too, her character and reliability, and the fact that she had not been called by the prosecution to support its case, even though she was its chief instigator. Many of the witnesses had disappeared or recanted their testimony. Betty Campbell could not be found. Zay Prevost, whose evidence was regarded as key, under intense pressure from the prosecutors and from Arbuckle's friends, fled abroad. three other witnesses disappeared, including the maid who had heard the woman's screams of, "No, no, no," and a man's reply, "Shut up." It looked bleak for the prosecution. The case for the state was leaking like a colander. On April the 12th, 1922, the jury of 12 men and women acquitted Roscoe Arbuckle after just 6 minutes' deliberation. They also issued an extraordinary public statement apologizing to him, then one by one shook hands with him. The statement began, "Acquittal is not enough for Roscoe Arbuckle." It then commended him for his manly attitude and ended, "We wish him success and hope the American people will see that Roscoe Arbuckle is entirely innocent and free from all blame." It was claimed the statement was written spontaneously by the jurors, but if it reads like a publicity handout, it is difficult not to suspect that that is precisely what it was. Although the trial eventually produced a result, an acquittal for Arbuckle, the manner of its doing so settled little on the question of whether or not he was responsible for Virginia Rappe's death. There are a great many disquieting aspects to the Virginia Rappe case. The reversed testimonies, the stream of witnesses discovered to be perjuring themselves, and the clear implication that they were in the pay of the defense, Arbuckle, and his friends, is unsettling. In the end, the final trial was a confused mass of conflicting evidence and unseemly abuse traded between counsel. Was Arbuckle guilty, or an unfortunate victim of malign, self-interested people and circumstances, as writers on the subject have claimed ever since? There are insuperable problems to the version of events Arbuckle gave, and they are hardly compatible with the evidence given by a host of witnesses, nor even with a common-sense understanding of the facts or of human behavior. In the first place, a urologist said that spontaneous bladder rupture was highly unlikely. It had been caused by external pressure. Other doctors concurred, and as a matter of fact, the overwhelming risk factor for ruptured bladder is blunt force trauma to the abdomen, often involving fracture of the pubic bones. Secondly, Arbuckle initially claimed he was never alone with Rappe, but he admitted subsequently that he was, and also that he had locked the door on them both. He tried to claim that he had done so before he realized Rappe was in the room. But even if the circumstances individually are conceivable, the sum of them is not. His version of events is not only improbable, it is unbelievable. Delmont claimed he followed Rappe into the room, or pulled her in. The best that can be said of this is that it is more likely than not. Why? Because of the fact that the two were alone in a locked room. Some circumstance led to this, and Arbuckle's claim of not being aware of her presence is the less likely explanation of the two. But if he did go into his room in the manner he claimed, a room where a woman whom he is known to have been pursuing for 5 years just happened to be alone at that time, did he really lock the door before becoming aware of her presence? It is a stretch. And even if he did so, why did he not call for assistance immediately upon finding her ill? Call her friends, Mrs. Delmont, for instance. Is it possible that while alone in his room with this beautiful woman whom he coveted, he carried her to the bed at her request? Would she not have sought her friends, rather than a man she was afraid of and was said to dislike? And all the while, Mrs. Delmont was hammering on the door, demanding that he open it. Others were gathering outside the door, too, presumably amused, if other events at the party are an indicator. And he, oblivious to all, and ostensibly in the room to change his clothes to take a woman to the station, was still in his pajamas. The woman was lying on his bed ill. There was a hullabaloo outside his door, and he, absent for at least 30 minutes, was doing what? And when the hotel assistant manager, Boyle, arrived, he opened the door wearing Virginia Rappe's hat. 30 minutes he had been in there alone with Virginia Rappe, and now emerged nonchalantly wearing her hat. And is it possible that the nature of Virginia Rappe's ailment, not previously known or treated by a doctor, manifested itself that day behind the locked door of a room in which she was alone with Arbuckle, and that it caused her to tear off her clothes. It is difficult to believe. And consider this. Roscoe Arbuckle did not, as Sherman claimed, hold a party on Labor Day for old friends to chat. It was a party with sex as its objective. His parties were known for this. A woman gave evidence that she had been warned of the sexual dangers of Arbuckle's parties. Sherman, Fishback, and Arbuckle did not go to San Francisco for a chat. They had a single purpose, and the subsequent behavior of all three of these men proved this. There were other oddities. Why was he in his pajamas? He claimed, unconvincingly in my view, that injury had made them more comfortable for him to wear. But principally, it was a sign of his libidinous intentions, as well as being a statement of his power as a star that he wore them. It is hard to accept that a beautiful woman, drunk, was in his room, alone with him, locked in that room with him, apart from her friends or any possibility of rescue, for an innocent reason. Or that she was lying on his bed with her underwear torn off because she had torn it off herself, nor on the bed because he had laid her there, having washed her face for her, and carried her in out of consideration, as he claimed. Would a man of such delicacy and of such gentle consideration towards her only minutes later admit to saying to her, "Shut up, or I'll throw you out of the window"? And yet the jury was asked to believe these two incompatible things. She had not, surely, as a matter of coincidence, while locked in Arbuckle's room alone with him, succumbed to such an unlikely event as her bladder spontaneously rupturing. Many people gave evidence she had been quite well beforehand. Would she have gone to the party had she not been? She had never seen a doctor about this strange malady the defense claimed she possessed, and those witnesses who claimed it were tainted, and several were found to have perjured themselves to establish this, or to be friends or acquaintances of Arbuckle's. Others were known to have tried to sell such false testimony to the defense, who appeared only to have mildly demurred at the offer. Virginia Rappe had seen a doctor only once in 8 years for a medical condition which had nothing to do with her bladder. Her only illnesses in recent years had been colds. The three doctors appointed by the court to examine the organs of Virginia Rappe declared there was nothing amiss with her, nor was there evidence of a pre-existing condition. She was not known to be promiscuous, nor to have venereal disease or another sexual ailment, as Max Sennett, a close friend of Arbuckle's, claimed. Nor was she pregnant. And set against this, at least 8 people, Maud Delmont, Betty Campbell, Zay Prevost, Alice Blake, Al Semnicker, and 3 nurses, all testified to being told by Virginia Rappe that Arbuckle had hurt her. That most of these changed their testimonies by the second and third trials to say quite the reverse subsequently, or disappeared, does not lessen the validity of their early statements. It reinforces it, and leads to the inevitable conclusion that they had, as the prosecutors believed and claimed, been bribed or otherwise got at by Arbuckle's friends and attorneys. That both of the men Arbuckle had traveled to the party with in his Pierce Arrow both attempted to employ the exact same strategy, i.e., that of locking a woman in their room against her will for sexual purposes, but were thwarted, is not coincidental. It suggests a behavior or practice common to all three men. As Lowell Sherman said on the stand, "Arbuckle was a big star. You don't question such men." Indeed. It is the case that the defense, in its efforts to win an acquittal for Arbuckle, attacked everyone and even made counter-accusations against the prosecutors of bullying and threatening witnesses to procure false evidence. But even if we can admit of the possibility that one or even two could have been pressured, it is against the run of common sense to accept that all of these people could be. 8 people, individually, agreed initially that Virginia Rappe had used words that accused Arbuckle. There were far too many people who gave accounts which accorded with that of Maud Delmont's for it to be possible for them all to have been suborned. It is for this reason that the balance of probability in the case lies with the prosecuting attorney Brady and the state. But when it came to the matter of proof, it was not sufficient. The first jury seemed to acknowledge a likelihood of Arbuckle's guilt in their deliberations. The second thought him guilty. This suggests that the argument lay along a fault line of proof, not of whether Arbuckle was responsible for her death, but whether it could be proved. The third jury's absolute acquittal is incomprehensible because it veers so far from the judgments of the earlier juries and of the known facts of the case. We have in recent years heard stories of powerful figures in the movie world acting in plain sight, abuse those in subordinate positions to themselves, and get away with it for a long period. Who can hear of the incident concerning Lowell Sherman's locking Betty Campbell in his room, those outside the door laughing, and the frightened woman escaping to the bathroom and thence to safety, without being reminded of the Harvey Weinstein case? Can anyone doubt what Sherman's intentions towards Betty Campbell were, or what Freddie Fishback's intentions were as she fled the bedroom in grabbing her and trying to force her back into the room? And for that matter, can it be doubted that Roscoe Arbuckle, in locking the door on himself and Virginia Rappe, had not the precise same object as his two friends in mind, the only difference being that in this case he succeeded where they did not, with tragic consequences? And as in recent cases in movie land, one of the most shocking revelations is that those who witness the events, who know of them, are compliant with them. Those outside the door laughing that Lowell Sherman is about to rape Betty Campbell laugh still. It is a human failing that by our supplication some amongst our number can be placed in positions of such power, way beyond their deserts or beyond anything that is sensible. We wish to make gods of those who only live and breathe and die as us, and in so doing we are the means of elevating such people to a point where abuse becomes almost a natural consequence. Henry Kissinger once said that power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. Perhaps, but it also provides the ultimate tool of abuse, the means by which the haves force into supplication the have-nots. Lord Acton's prescriptive here is closer to the mark. All power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Arbuckle was at the top of the tree in 1921. He lived a wild life. He was not the cuddly ingenue of his movies, the lovable country bumpkin of his comedies. We wish our movie stars, our heroes, to be as the characters they portray on screen. Of course, they are not. They are actors. They are real people. Roscoe Arbuckle was at once a more world-wise man, a more intelligent man without doubt, and was highly gifted. But he had his failings. He was probably addicted to morphine, a habit he had formed after a serious leg injury in 1916. He was a heavy drinker, certainly, a serial womanizer. His parties were opportunities for sexual encounters for him and his friends. They were always supplied copiously with drink and young women. He was not unique in this. So many other stars, plumped up with fame and the arrogance it nurtures, were notoriously remiss in their sexual conduct. But Arbuckle was the one caught. That might have seemed unfair to some. His colleagues undoubtedly sympathized with him. But it was from the dubious and skewed perspective that everyone else was doing it too. It is the moral panacea of the reprobate. Arbuckle earned big, and he spent big, too. He liked to throw parties. "Late hours and lots of parties keep me in the pink," he was quoted as saying, and he was known for his insatiable pursuit of women. "If there weren't beautiful women in the world," he told his friend Max Sennett, "I wouldn't want to live." He boasted to Adela Rogers St. John's in a photoplay interview in 1920 of his attractiveness to women and predicted that the time of the big man was coming. There was nothing unusual in all of this for a big screen star, but even by Hollywood standards, his parties were bywords for excess. Joyce Clark, A cafe singer who was invited to the Labor Day party by Arbuckle said he had been warned of the sexual aspects of his parties. And Henry Lehrman, the fiancé of the dead woman, said that when he had directed Arbuckle in his movies, he had had to warn him to stay away from the women on set. Arbuckle seemed to be unable to stop himself, and as his friend Lowell Sherman said, he was a big star. You don't question a big star. There was no shortage of beautiful young women willing to trade their charms for the favor of a powerful man at St. Francis Hotel on that Labor Day in 1921. But Roscoe Arbuckle had a different objective that day, another lust to satisfy. The beautiful Virginia Rappe was one woman who had not succumbed to his charms. He had pursued her for 5 years, all the time he had known her, but without success. Perhaps Virginia was not a woman who guarded her virtue jealously, but she was simply not interested in him. There is nothing a man who always gets what he wants prizes so highly as that which he cannot have. He denied himself nothing, yet he was being denied. It was an itch he could not scratch. He had made numerous efforts, and even once tried to get hold of the key to her room so that he could, he claimed, play a prank on her. The security guard refused the star, to his credit. It is easy to imagine the kind of prank such a man as Roscoe Arbuckle might play, the same kind of prank Lowell Sherman tried to play on Betty Campbell, and Freddie Fishback was also willing to try the humor of. Of course, for Betty Campbell, as for Virginia Rappe, the joke was a little one-sided. The doorman sensed it. He knew picture people. He doubtless knew Arbuckle and his reputation, and so did Virginia Rappe. She had said to Lehrman that he was vulgar and disrespectful of women. She felt uncomfortable with the man. Virginia had a few drinks, was probably quite drunk, and Arbuckle got her into his bedroom, perhaps on the pretext of discussing her career away from the party, perhaps just by pulling her in, as the prosecution claimed, and Delmont had described earlier. Arbuckle closed the door and turned the key in the lock. Virginia Rappe had no means of escape. She almost certainly tried. The handprints suggest this, no matter that the defense did all it could to dismiss these, to claim they had been faked because a maid had cleaned the room thoroughly before it had been dusted for prints. Did she really wipe all the upper surface of the doors over? What a diligent maid. Virginia Rappe was trapped in his room. There is no innocent construction that can be placed on this. Or if there is one, then it escapes me. With all this in mind, there are two critical questions to consider in the Arbuckle case. The first is, did something happen of a sexual nature behind that locked door between Virginia Rappe and Arbuckle? The second is, if it did, and only if it did, was it a consensual act or not? Taking question one, it seems beyond any possible doubt that something sexual occurred between them. Everything points decidedly to this. Both of the first two juries argued the toss on this point. The second question is more difficult. Was it consensual? The matter of whether she was ill or not now falls away with question two, legally and morally, because if it was not consensual, then it was murder, whether she had a medical condition or not. In the past 40 years or so, the nature of consent has changed. The criteria applied that constitute an act of rape are quite different to those which defined it 100 years ago. Social and cultural factors have influenced it, as have changes in public attitudes. But even with this taken into consideration, it seems to me that it was probably not a consensual act. There are a number of things which suggest this. One, the fact that she was injured. It is a great deal more likely, for obvious reasons, that such a big and heavy man would injure a woman during sex which was not a consensual act or was resisted than would be the case where there was consent. 2. The configuration of the handprints on the door suggests she had tried to escape. 3. Virginia Rappe, even if drunk, and though in great pain, was anxious that Henry Lehrman, her fiancé, should not learn of the matter. Why? Because it is an unfortunate fact that a victim is often blamed for the crime of their assailant in such a case. It certainly suggests that she was not willing. 4. Her words to 8 people that Roscoe had done this were accusatory. They suggest again that he did not have her consent. 5. The bruising on her arms and legs suggests a degree of violence or a degree of roughness that make a consensual act improbable. 6. Arbuckle's conduct afterwards, shut up or I'll throw you out of the window, are a continuation of aggression and do not accord with his claims of care and consideration for her. 7. And the testimony of Betty Campbell that he was grinning afterwards, of Maud Delmont that he was wearing Virginia's hat at a rakish angle, these are the attributes of the conqueror, of one who has triumphed. Her hat is his trophy. All of these things imply an absence of consent, but no more than this. None of this is the kind of proof that a court of law quite rightly requires in such a case, but it amply supplies us, in my view, with the truth of the matter, and the truth is important. What Maud Delmont said, "I have wanted you for 5 years," sounds in every respect to fit the circumstances of that encounter in room 1219. And consider this, Maud Delmont was not in a position to know that Arbuckle had known Rappe for 5 years. Few did know it, but Arbuckle knew it, and he said it. It bears out her testimony. That was heard by Prevost. He had wanted her for 5 years. He had pursued her for 5 years. He had been separated for 4 years himself. She was recently parted from Lehrman. He was alone with her in a locked room now. There were no others present. Maud Delmont was a terrible witness to have to rely on, but because she was a bigamist, it does not follow that were her words ring with the authority of truth, they should be dismissed. She had a bad character, but there weren't many parish priests or League of Decency women present at the party in Fatty Arbuckle's suite that day. Matthew Brady had only such witnesses because they were the only ones present at the party. Maud Delmont did knock on the door of 1219. She called out and tried the door, as she said she did, and finding it locked and hearing Virginia scream, she began to kick the door furiously. Her act was entirely consistent with every aspect of what we know of the situation in the suite and in room 1219 that day. The tales that Virginia had had numerous abortions were simply untrue, and it was part of a policy to discredit, even to revile, the dead woman. Nor was she pregnant. The 3 doctors employed by the court to disentangle the various testimonies of state and defense doctors, who each came with a different opinion, were clear on this. Nor was there any other abnormality, sexual disease, or anything else to suggest she was not a normal young woman. It is too often the last refuge of a hopeless defense to accuse the victim. And her promiscuity, if it was true, it was not, was irrelevant. We know she did not wish to have sex with Roscoe Arbuckle, and it is enough. Claims relating to bladder infections are also of no relevance. Cystitis does not cause a bladder to rupture, and there was no evidence she had suffered from this. Her injuries were caused by great pressure being imposed on the abdomen. We should also, I think, acknowledge that Virginia Rappe's death was never Arbuckle's intention. Her death must have shocked him profoundly. It was also a sad end to a talented man's career, a man who did so much for the development of the picture industry as an art form in the 20th century and gave so much laughter and pleasure to millions of ordinary people, was ruined and lost to us. After the trial, there were parties thrown for Fatty Arbuckle in Hollywood, at which alcohol was conspicuously absent. He was feted. He was fined $500 for breaching prohibition laws after the trial. He had a meeting with Paramount 2 weeks after his acquittal. It was decided that he should take a break to let things die down and to allow the public memory to fade, and so he undertook a world trip. But the public memory did not fade. He was no longer the winsome, chubby, nice guy, the lovable simpleton, nor could he ever be again. He continued as a director, writer, and films, using the name William Goodrich, was to a degree rehabilitated to the public. But the stains of accusation, the exposure of his character, his rapacious, predatory, sexual nature was hard to reconcile with the humorous, shy, lovable bumpkin he had created so memorably for the screen. He was divorced from Minta Durfee in 1925 and married Doris Dean that same year. They divorced 3 years later, and he married a final time to Addie MacPhail in June 1932. A year later, on the 29th of June 1933, after negotiating a contract with Warner Brothers and a return to the big screen, he died of a heart attack in his sleep. He was 46 years old. Virginia Rappe, whose life was cut short on the 9th of September 1921 at the age of 30, was buried at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery in a dress provided by Charlie Chaplin's wife, Mildred, on the 19th of September 1921. Henry Lehrman paid $1,000 for flowers to cover her casket. The funeral was well attended. Oliver Hardy was a pallbearer. Lehrman remained embittered towards Arbuckle all his life and apparently threatened to kill him. It was hardly surprising. He died in 1946 and was laid to rest in the same Hollywood Forever Cemetery in a grave alongside that of the woman who had once been his fiancée, Virginia Rappe.
Friday, we would do a real story, Hollywood's true story. This Friday coming up, William Randolph Hearst, Bastard, the true Hollywood story. Thank you for listening. I'm Brian the Hammer Jackson, and you're listening to the podcast of Murder, He Wrote. Every Friday we'll be doing live stories. We'll get into mafia. We'll get into murders in Hollywood. We'll get into serial killers. They're all true story. And that's what we're going to do every Friday. If you want to be interviewed, I do live interviews. If you want to be interviewed, all you have to do is contact me. You can contact me through email, which is Brian Hammerjack. Well, it'll be better if you look at the marquee and you can see where you can get an interview by me. We are global, worldwide. A lot of audience. And that's it. You can find me on Facebook at Brian Hammer Jackson, Twitter at Hammer AOD, and LinkedIn, Brian Hammer Jackson. So that's it. That ends our today Murder, He Wrote, and every Friday we will be doing real crime stories. Thank you, and good night. We'll see you tomorrow at 7 a.m. a regular show talking about current events. Until then, good night.
In the crib, ma. Drop it like it's hot. Drop it like it's hot. Drop it like it's hot. When the pigs try to get at you, park it like it's hot. Park it like it's hot. Park it like it's hot. And if a get an attitude, pop it like it's hot. Pop it like it's hot. Pop it like it's hot. I got the rollie on my arm and I'm pouring Chandon and I'm full of best cause I got it going on. I'm a nice dude with some nice dreams. See these ice cubes. See these ice creams. Eligible bachelor. $1 million bow. That's whiter than what's in your throat. The phantom exterior like fish eggs. The interior like this red. I can exercise you. This could be your fifth ed. Cheat on your man, man. That's how you get it. Killer with the V. I know killers in the street. With the feel to make you feel like chinchilla in the heat. So don't try to run up on my ear talking all that raspy. Trying to ask me. When my figure they ain't gonna pass me. You should think about it. Take a second. Matter of fact, you should take 4B and think before you make a little skateboard B. When the pimp's in the crib, ma, drop it like it's hot.